Hey everyone, this is Zach Weiss from Worn & Wound. Thanks for tuning in. On today's show, we're trying something a bit different. I'm kicking off a new series where I ask a broad question to several brands separately and string together the conversations that follow into one episode. The idea is to get a variety of opinions on a topic, have some interesting dialogues, and hopefully create an entertaining and informative podcast. To kick things off, I rounded up Bradley Price, the founder of Autodromo, TJ McKnight, the director of Zodiac Watches, Paul Sweetenham, the founder of Farrer Watches, and Jason Lim, founder of Helios Watches. The question posed was, what are the biggest challenges and opportunities facing watch brands right now? First up is Bradley Price of Autodromo. Enjoy the show.
Well, I think that in some ways the pandemic has been not entirely negative for smaller, less expensive brands, like under $1,000, because they're entirely web-based generally, and they're not reliant on a traditional dealer chain, you know, where like stores would be closed, et cetera. And I'm kind of anecdotally hearing that a lot of the smaller brands are kind of doing okay right now, which is nice to hear. But I think that it's still like a challenge that I've kind of spoken about before when we've talked, which is that there's just so much stuff out there. And I still think that's kind of like one of the biggest challenges for brands is to break through all the static and to kind of be able to communicate their message and get their name out there, get people excited about the product without kind of having dilution of the message or kind of lots of other voices going on at the same time. And that's something that's certainly gotten harder over the last few years compared to when I started. But I also think the pandemic, I don't know who we don't know what's going to happen, obviously, but it may sort out some of the brands as well. I mean, there may be a culling. I don't know. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. It's certainly like the biggest kind of open question for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, apart from the, like, the obvious retail, in-person retail side of it, you know, because the Richemont or whatever just posted a huge, huge projected losses, but it's all because of the, store retail. Like, yeah, I mean, online sales for the time being seem to be up. So that certainly is helping brands. But, you know, I do think this is an interesting point and one that obviously goes beyond just the current situation, which is like that there does seem to be an awful lot of small brands popping up. And, you know, I think you've been around since it was around 2011 that you got your start.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah.
2011.
Yeah, we launched in 2011. So I started working on it 2 years before that. So 2009 is really when I started the.
So it's pre the whole Kickstarter surge and pre, like, you know, really even Instagram being like the top kind of social media network, which I think has obviously stimulated a lot of like watch brands growth, you know. But the idea of it being really crowded is kind of an interesting topic unto itself. I mean, I guess, like, just to veer from there, like, how would you suggest to a brand to kind of like approach finding their story or how to differentiate themselves at this point?
Well, I just think that people, I don't know. I often wonder what inspires some people to start a watch brand versus others.
Yeah.
I feel like most of the brands that I know and respect are owned by designers who wanted to make their own products and had original designs that they wanted to manufacture. But there's a whole other category of watch companies out there that are basically more, I hate to say brand driven because they're not necessarily brand driven, but I mean, it's more like they're putting a logo on an existing watch that some factory's already producing. Yeah. And they're kind of like adding maybe a unique colorway and tweaking it, but they're kind of, they're not really designing an original product. And I just don't, sometimes I wonder what is in it for those people? Like, is it purely a business concept that they have or that they think is going to be profitable, or I don't know. But this is something that I've seen with a lot of brands, not necessarily brands that you guys would cover, but just things out there, you know, or things that pop up on Instagram that are sponsored posts. And so I would say that, like, I just would like to see brands that have an original point of view and have like an interesting aesthetic and kind of original design. And that those are the brands that I think have risen to the top, very quickly, or that people in this space know by name, are those brands that are really, design driven.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny you bring that up, because I was just looking at a brand the other day that, like, I sort of had forgotten existed, and they're not a brand. I'm not going to name them, because this is not the nicest thing to say in the world. But I was looking at their watches, and I was just thinking, basically, like what you're just saying, like they sort of hopped on this sort of Daniel Wellington trend, which, God, that's a brand I actually haven't thought about much in a long time. I don't really know what they're doing. I assume they're still out there and pretty big. But that sort of like pseudo faux luxe minimalist sort of thing that was going on, which seemed like each iterative brand that was just trying to hop on that, money train, just put a different logo
totally
on there.
And you probably do that. I get emails all the time, and I don't know, you guys probably get them too, but like, some factory in mainland China will send you a PDF of 50 watch designs that they're just like that. They're like a museum store kind of watch or whatever. And you could just order 500 of them with your logo on them and call it a brand, And yeah. There's just way too much of that going on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I feel like maybe seems like the Kickstarter sort of world like has gotten a little bit more mistrustful or there's still plenty of brands launching there, but I think it's become less of like the go-to. So hopefully those brands are kind of waning right now, because that was the cash grab.
I do think that wave is sort of crested, at least just my instinct feeling about it, but who knows?
Yeah.
Could be another wave. You never know.
Yeah. So once again, like apart from the pandemic, then right now, like what do you think are the greatest opportunities that are out there for watch brands, like either in growth or design or, however you see that?
Well, I do think that, as I said before, the brands that are selling online and particularly at lower price points seem to be doing okay. And I think that for like the more established brands, figuring out how to sell online is going to be their biggest challenge. Mm-hmm. If this really stays into a prolonged situation, or if lots of authorized dealers actually go under, they're just going to have to find new ways of presenting their product and selling it. And so I think that's a big opportunity that some people some brands will be able to capitalize on, and others will not.
Yeah.
So that's certainly, I do think that figuring out the challenges of selling in the online world is still the number one challenge and priority for most brands, I would say. Certainly for mine. And I'm certainly don't claim to have it figured out either. But it's definitely the toughest nut to crack and the most important.
Yeah. Would you like say as like a smaller, brand in the scheme of watch brands out there that obviously go up to Rolex and other large brands, is the challenge, would you say, for you, like bringing people to the store, educating people about the brand? Like,
I think it's making the product available and making people aware that they can buy the product and making that as streamlined as possible. And I think the challenge is that although it is inexpensive to advertise on Facebook and with Google, like anyone, you literally spend $10 or whatever, anyone can afford to do that. To really do it in a masterful way and to really get results, it takes, I think, someone who really understands the nitty-gritty of how those things work. And can create audiences that are very nuanced and really target people. Yeah. And to do that, you either have to be good at that yourself, which I certainly am not, or you have to find someone who can do that or an agency who can do that. And the problem that I find is that most of the agencies that approach us or that we hear about, they're kind of geared towards the, like working for someone like Casper Mattress, let's say, who has venture capital. And they're basically going to spend somewhere around, $500,000 a month at least on advertising. And the idea being that it's just like a simple mathematical formula that you pour in a shitload of money at one end of this machine.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're going to spit out an even larger amount of sales at the other end of it. And it does work, I think, at least for a time. But the thing is that it's kind of like you can't just dribble in small amounts of money. It's like it requires this kind of like flood of money that most small brands don't have access to and wouldn't, you know, realistically spend. Yeah. And so it's very hard to find the right fit where you can have an agency that can work on a small budget and that has strategies geared towards people that don't have like massive amounts of VC money to just kind of flow into the advertising.
Yeah. 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 Online marketing really, it's a fascinating subject. And it's obviously something, you know, we're involved with, like in that we work with an agency to kind of help us, you know, promote things and to, you know, the amount of, I mean, it's essentially like a science that goes into it and fine tuning it and like Ali learning how the algorithms work. Cause it kind of like, you know, it seems like you could be like, oh, well, I want to advertise to guys who like watches. It's that simple, but like that doesn't work. You know, it's like you have to drill down really specifically and then you have to, you know, like fine tune little thing, like how you're spending more money there versus there. And I remember hearing, and this is, you know, sort of anecdotal, but you know, a lot of projects on Kickstarter, you know, they might say I have a $20,000 goal, but they really want to get $2 million or something like that. But in order to get
totally.
Like the marketing, they all work with these marketing agencies now that have just sprung up around Kickstarter. In order to get there, it's like, well, then you have to actually spend around like 10% of your real goal. So you're spending $200,000 to get, you know, and it's like you're saying, I mean, that's a lot of money. That's a lot more money than I think anyone, like especially a small brand that isn't a large business or has a large business behind it, it's really going to be ready to kind of roll into it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so what it comes down to is just having the savvy of knowing how to set up those programs, which is, again, it's incredibly technical and it's a challenge.
Yeah.
And I know there are definitely some brands doing it well, but I also think that it seems like you have to be, willing to spend a lot of money to really like saturate and to get the kind of exposure that you need.
Yeah, definitely. That's, I mean, in the end, unfortunately, that's kind of what seems to win out. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder what alternative kind of channels there will be in the future. You know, I mean, Instagram was one for a time being. Now it's obviously become pretty, out corporate in a sense, you know, I mean, it's the same thing. You have to fight against so many other people.
Well, yeah,
it's
like, I mean, especially since Facebook really firmly took it over.
Oh,
I think it's definitely suffered in terms of its organic appeal. But, you know, people are still on it and addicted to it.
Yeah.
But
well, it's still a great channel for the like the organic talking to your, you know, fans and the people who already are following you. But I wonder, it's like, as just a marketing outlet, like the power there seems to have been lost a little bit because it's gotten so, you know, essentially monetized in all these different ways by Instagram.
Yeah.
Every new day, there's some other, you know, aspect to it. There's shopping carts on there now. There's all sorts of things like.
Yeah, I use the shopping cart feature, but I actually don't do sponsored posts, believe it or not. I've never, all of our stuff is organic, but that's also been frustrating because it used to be we would get a lot more engagement before they changed the algorithm.
And
we would, you know, we would be seen by a much larger percentage of our followers. But now, because I'm not paying to like boost posts, it's really like the more the hardcore people that really like the brand that see most of it. But, you know, but yeah, I did set up the checkout, but you know, it goes through Facebook to check out, which again is completely asinine. That it should directly go to your online store from Instagram, but instead you have to set up a store in Facebook, which nobody in their right mind would use. And then you have to like go through that to check out. I mean, it's very, very
very convoluted.
I used to have a client years ago in my industrial design life that he had this great term called user hostile. And it was kind of things that were built into a program or to a product that were designed for the benefit of the company that made it rather than the person using it. Things like, you know, custom cords that you can't just plug in, you know, easily, stuff like that. You know, so it's like kind of user hostile.
I feel like
the checkout is very user hostile.
Yeah, totally. I'm like looking at the product just on my table right now, and I'm like, oh, Apple, was that for me or you?
Oh yeah, no, Apple is the king of user hostile. Yeah. I mean, it's like if you don't want to completely submit to their entire suite of products and their entire life that they want to sell you, it's kind of like very hard to kind of jump back and forth between those platforms.
Yeah, for sure. Very interesting.
Next up is TJ McKnight of Zodiac Watches.
Well, I think the biggest thing that's more evident now is distribution. You know, retailers and brands both through the pandemic and just in general are going to have to be pushed more digitally, you know, from an e-commerce perspective. And it's a big disruption. And I think everyone's trying to get there. But I think, you know, the events of just that just happened over the last 6 months is making everyone relook at their business models. How do they interact with brands? And it's going to be a big trend and a big topic for any of the retailers that successfully navigate the difficult times right now.
Yeah. Do you think this has kind of forced people to look at like the inevitable changes that were coming?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, just from a business sense, you know, if you look at your income right now, if you're a brick and mortar and you don't have the ability to service your customers, if you don't have a digital presence, you know, it's going to be tough to survive.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. I always kind of find that it interesting how there's only a handful of retailers out there that have kind of really sort of capitalized on social media. And, you know, they're before Instagram or whatever, they were, you know, they're small regional retailers and now they feel like larger entities. But that's just because they've rode the wave that was coming and got on a little earlier. Now all the ones that aren't are facing this really harsh reality right now of having like no ability to sell. But then when things come back to some level of normal, you know, will the reality be like, well, things got moved ahead 5 years. They have to adjust quickly, very quickly.
Right. And I think a lot of these jewelers, you know, the ones I've interacted, there's a whole new generation of owners. And I think they're seeing this. They know that driving communities through social and interacting is good for business. So the old traditional model of, you know, these guys are experts when it comes to products is going to be difficult. Yeah. Consumers are researching online. They're not necessarily walking into jewelers. And plus, it's intimidating. You know, millennials come in and it's, you know, the interaction to buy an expensive product like Swiss watches, you know, it's intimidating. And, you know, unfortunately, millennials and younger generations want to hide behind the internet and do their research and purchase. So, yeah, it's going to be a big change. And I think, you know, it was something that was evolving. Even brands, most brands, you know, still don't sell e-commerce and they sell directly through their retailers, which is a great thing. But I think brands are going to have to relook at it. And there's a lot of difficulties that come along with that. The strategies of holding price, you know, the digital world is not territorial. Mm-hmm. So you've got, you know, retailers that might be on the West Coast. Now they're going to be able to sell globally. How do you manage that? So there's a whole list of complexities that go along with it. But I think, you know, it's going to move faster than that we anticipated. And the ones that move fast and that are agile will still be here and they'll do a great job. And the ones that aren't are going to have a difficult time.
Yeah. You actually touched on something interesting I haven't really thought too much about. But like, you know, from the side of, you know, a larger brand with kind of mix of different types of distribution and outlets, like, what is this, the next generation like? You know, like, I only kind of know my generation and I remember a time before cell phones and all of that, but like, what is the challenge, you know, of dealing with a younger audience and trying to, frankly, you know, acquire them as customers? And, you know, are the strategies around that being developed? And, you know, is TikTok the way you're going to sell watches in the future? Like,
You know, I don't know. I think there's a little bit of, you know, there is a very young consumer set out there that has disposable income. They behave differently. You know, they're not, you know, just for instance, there was, when we did the event, with you at one of our jewelers here in Texas, And we had a lot of young guys from some of the watch collectors groups, and they were up there, and there was one young guy, and he was sneakers, and he looked like a young kid, but he had disposable income. He bought expensive watches, and he was explaining, I believe, to Blake that, he's had so many bad experiences walking into a traditional jeweler that he was looking to spend $10,000, $15,000 on a watch and basically didn't get service because, it's hard to connect, I think, with some of these younger guys. So I don't know. I think a lot of it from you're going to have to spend more time developing your brand as a retailer, and that you have that ability to speak the language of young people. Because that's the people that are going to be spending money. When you look at the really high end, those are still going to be very serviced very differently. When you talk about the uber wealthy and the watches that cost, upwards of $200,000 or $300,000, it's a way different ballgame. But if you're looking at watch brands, under $25,000 or $50,000, all the way down to $1,000, that's, I think it's going to change rapidly. And that's a big volume area. So I don't know. It's going to be hard. We focus on partnering with great partners like you guys at Worn and Wound and other editorial slash retailers to try to figure that out. And I think us communicating and doing really cool stuff is our first step. But we're heavily weighing on partners that have a good digital presence, even when we pick jewelers, that they have that approach of not just traditional, regional brick and mortar, but they also have a layer of e-commerce, and it helps us work better.
I also, I think about some of the conversation we have, obviously off, this podcast, but just normal conversations and the ideas of a like storytelling and being, really driving your brand. And I think it's really interesting because sometimes, we get press releases from very well-known brands and they're great watches at our price point, but there's really little more than just here's the watch, here's the specs. And like how that's really starting to get boring, and like whereas you work with Andy Mann or you work with some other cool guy or through 111 you work with some interesting nature initiatives and dudes who climb and hike and stuff like that. And like, yeah, the watch is part of that, and I feel like that's kind of communicating to this different and younger audience. Hopefully it's right. It's less like, oh yeah, the object comes with it, but it's more about the point, the purpose.
And no, I think that's a good point. I think people want to fall in love with a story, or they want a value that's not tangible. There's a lot of really great brands, and they know how to make really good products. And there's movements out there, and I think that's something that is expected when you make a good watch. The people, the customers that I've talked to, there's a list of things they expect if you're going to make a Swiss watch. But then taking that ability and differentiate it a little bit and kind of romancing it, especially when it's kind of a retro revival piece, I think people fall in love with it. The other thing is these young consumers don't know the historical pieces. Like this, a lot of them are new to watches. So I think there's like a re-education, and that's why you see a lot of brands reissuing products, because I think, storytelling is super important, and I think there's going to be a big push for education. And then I think these consumers are going to fall in love with watches all over again. And then you'll see that next generation really consume and collect watches again. But I think that's where the brands have to do their part. If they're just making watches, there's a lot of people making watches. You just got to go that next level.
Interesting. Something I was also just thinking about, how does like, I mean, I'll just be blunt, like how does the Apple Watch really, like what is the threat there that you've seen from, the side of the more kind of affordable timepieces and the retail timepieces, like, especially with this sort of audience, like what is the challenge there? Like, how do you overcome, if that is even the approach, something like the Apple Watch?
Well, I think the Apple Watch was a big disruption, especially when you look at the price points under $500. I think technology is always great. From my experience, what we've seen, it's really disrupted on the female side. A lot of when it, a lot of the fashion and stuff like that consumer that was buying a lot of fashion brands have been primarily female in the growth aspect of it. And I think you've seen a lot of females, and I know my wife and everyone have bought the Apple Watch. But the Apple Watch, it's a fitness tool. In my opinion, it is not a a status symbol. They do color up the Apple Watches. They're amazing straps, and there's really cool stuff you can do to it. And it's a really good watch, but it's, you know, I work with executives that wear a fitness tracker or a smartwatch, and they wear a traditional watch.
Yeah.
So I think it's here to stay, but I don't think, you know, especially from the men's side, that it's going to be a huge disruption. If you look at the Swiss brands, like, you know, the behemoths in this segment, their businesses are on fire, even with Apple. If you're talking about like the Rolexes of the world, they're still doing amazing. So, you know, I think it's here to stay. Honestly, they're probably one of the largest watch companies in the world now. I think they
just did double the amount of sales that like all Swiss watch companies did, something like that.
Yeah. So it's crazy. They're here to stay. But I think it's, you know, I think it's a different segment. And like I said, you know, I still see, you know, really good traditional product not going away, even though they say, you know, it's going to kill timing. You know, watches are something that's really personal and really meaningful. And to me, it's like men don't wear a lot of jewelry, at least here in the U.S. They wear a watch, they wear a wedding ring. So it's like an accessory piece or, you know, something that brings value to them. So when you think of specific timing, we all have cell phones, we all have, you know, the ability to tell time. But it's how you engage with the products and you know what it means to you, I think is where, you know, where timing is going. It's an accessory, and I think it's not going anywhere.
Next, we have Paul Sweetenham from Farrer.
I guess, certainly from our perspective, right? Never mind general watch brands. I think the greatest opportunity and therefore challenge is one of just awareness. I mean, the recent pandemic has encouraged a greater level of purchasing online than I'm sure there was before. You know, nothing original in that comment, and certainly true of many industries. But I think the watch world would have had a big positive benefit, you know, on those who have perhaps been skeptical. So that's very good from that perspective. But of course, what it does also mean is that you continually have to work very, very, very hard on the critical number one mission, which is awareness, you know, bearing in mind, of course, online, you're seeking to build awareness for a population of billions, not a few people in, or not a few thousand people in a local. So I think that is a great challenge, particularly, you know, with all the elements changing today. We've got the Facebook shop initiative from the Facebook guys, you know, the fully integrated Facebook, Instagram, non-charging thing. Just keeping pace with everything, I think, is tricky. And we're very fortunate because of a particular business in our group that we own. We have a brand performance team. So focusing on return on advertised spend is sort of second nature for us. Maybe it wouldn't be second nature for every watch company, but it certainly is to us because it's a sort of skill set on the side. But nevertheless, it's a very challenging thing to stay relevant, to stay top of the tree. And then secondly, I think with that, you know, if you want to describe the online world as just a ginormous appetite, then of course, what does an appetite need? It needs feeding. And, you know, long gone are the days now where I think that you could rely on a sort of balanced, ranged with a few bestsellers. The reality is, you know, we're finished out to 2021 September in terms of product. Not here's a thought, right? But actual developed product initiatives, prototypes complete, production booked, and quantities decided.
Wow.
I mean, it's bonkers. We have been at this since 2016. In 2016, you used to be able to do that in 6 months. And the lead time in the business is almost contrary to the rest of the entire world and every other product type getting longer. And it's primarily because, you know, the resources available, particularly around dials, are limited if you want to have an exceptional dial, and I'm sure everyone wants an exceptional dial, then there are not a huge amount of world resources for that. So two things really: the length of time you have to work out and the awareness challenge, because of course you're up against the big gun, aren't you? And these guys have got endless resources. You have the advantage that you can appear at the same size on a screen as everyone else, for sure. I get that. That's an advantage. But you have to be able to spend your money very wisely in order to stay top of awareness. You know, doesn't sound particularly exciting, but I think it's probably the number one challenge for everyone.
So what do you see like in terms of awareness and in terms of being a smaller brand, but by no means the smallest? I mean, there's plenty of brands that are, you know, one person doing this on their own time, but like, just thinking about that sort of, there's a bit of a level playing field, like you said, because in the internet you can get in front of so many people, but then there's the resource question. So like, what approaches do you take to stand out?
So we do a lot of genuine adventures, right? So we, you know, there are a number of people, I'm certainly not criticizing, but it's, I guess it's down to their resources and their funds, who make a sort of suggestive connection to a particular activity. I get that. I fully get that. Certainly not knocking it. But we think, in order to stay relevant in the authenticity grouping, which is our desired sort of group, then you have to do stuff. And so although this pandemic has by no means interrupted business particularly, it has interrupted our ability to get out and do adventures. And we feel that is particularly critical, and therefore the adventure activity that we have got for tomorrow's release of the Aqua Compressor had to be manufactured up of preparation trip that we'd done rather than the actual final trip. But you know, that's a sort of individual circumstances. The actual genuine challenge is to consistently do relevant, interesting, and appropriate activity to support your brand, to make sure that you're suggestive in the activities that you want to be related to. If they don't choose to do them, fine. But I think a lot of people do refer to them, and our videos are watched by thousands and thousands and thousands of folks, which we're very grateful for. So I think that's very important. Then, of course, it's the continuous upgrading of your website experience. So we have a parallel activity that is going on outside of live today that will, again, enhance the Faro website towards the end of the year. And of course, whilst you're doing it, no doubt there will be further technical leaps in things that you're able to do. You've got to be careful that you're not building the road bridge that never gets to the other side kind of thing on this. But I think they're very relevant. And then, of course, I think what is obviously very relevant is the appropriate level of models. And
that's very interesting.
You know, the appropriate level of newness. Because I think that bestsellers is a great business strategy, but not everyone has a sufficient big enough bestseller. You know, a sort of lame reference would be a, you know, Submariner. And then sufficient new releases, and making sure, you know, that in your new releases, you have a minimum level of take-up. You don't have a poor take-up. You know, otherwise you'll end up with a long tail of, I guess, an interesting catalog, but it's not a particularly relevant or successful, you know. So we sell a lot of things out. And then we have to decide, you know, what is going to stay and what is not going to stay, or what is going to stay in a new iteration, you know.
Yeah, you've done that a few times, or you sort of have dropped a, like, you use, I always think of your brand working in threes, which seems to be the way you continue to do this. You have a new release, but there's three sub varieties of it that are kind of within that theme. And then occasionally you drop a fourth. And that one's...
Occasionally we drop a fourth. Then we might decide to withdraw. Or then we might decide to say, do you know what? That was a good direction. But actually, you know, as a good example, we sort of done a lot of chronographs. We haven't done any chronographs this year. There won't be any chronographs this year. Hmm. But next year, there are a lot of chronographs. And it's kind of repositioning our chronographs. And I think it's just difficult to make sure that, you know, there is a chronograph customer and then there is a customer that has no interest in chronographs at all.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure you get a balance of watches that are relevant seasonally. So, if, you know, hence our Echo Compressor is deliberately a summer watch. Mm-hmm. We sell them in the winter for sure, we do, but we sell much more in the summer. And then, you know, you sell your GMTs all year round. And then something like a chronograph has a spike of interest. And then, you know, it obviously loses momentum. Mm. And then spikes again for whatever reasons. But a continuing balanced catalogue of product range is very important. Yeah. And, you know, I guess it's like the third, the fourth, the fifth album. You know, you've got to make sure there's no filler.
You know? Right. Right. Yeah, it's rare to find, though, a band with, like, a great fifth album, you know?
Exactly. you want to sort of build the sustaining power of the Rolling Stones, not too many other bands have got that, but there you go.
Yeah, I guess Black Sabbath is only the first three albums, and then they trail.
A lot of them are, though, aren't they? You know, a lot of, if we're honest about it, a lot of them are. Yeah.
I'm also kind of curious about this, what you touched on with just manufacturing. I mean, obviously right now there's going to be, a ripple effect from just places being closed down, but it sounds like there's kind of always shortages in the watch industry. And I thought it was interesting that you mentioned dials. I feel like most people talk about movements. Has that changed recently that it's more the dial side? Are there less dial manufacturers now, or is this...
I think that several of our peer group are doing more interesting dials than they did before. Mm-hmm. We are ourselves. We always think we've had interesting dials, but we've put more into them. Mm-hmm. Skill in dial making, you know, I still retain is undervalued in the horological horizon. You know, everyone gets very excited about the movements, you know, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. But it isn't the movement that you stare at. You stare at the dial. And, you know, and there is a skill set, because you've got to be able to make a very high level of intricacy, a huge number of stages, and then every single dial has to be exactly 1,000,000% the same.
Yeah.
That's a tough skill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a tough skill. And then also we're in the process of doing one particular watch, which was going to be out in October. And we wanted to do a bezel in a material that is not currently used in the market.
Hmm.
And in the end, we looked all over the world, and it ended up being in a small workshop about 10 miles down the road in Switzerland.
Oh, wow.
And we're forging this and working this with them, a specific material that is not generally, in fact, to my knowledge, is not used in the watch world for a rotating bezel on a particular model next year. And, you know, that's, you've got to look to find your own DNA and do things that are individual, yeah. You know, and ceramic is a great thing to use. And we've been very successful on the white ceramic Bernina, and we've developed some new colors for ceramic bezels for chronographs next year. Mm-hmm. But it takes such a long time, Zach. You know, okay. The lead time is like making a car.
Is mad. That because of just in general the lead time on ceramic, or because of the development cycle for colors?
I think that if you want to take a stock ceramic, the lead time is long enough. But if you want to make a bespoke ceramic color, you know, because you have to get the part, pass that... We're not of a size typically to excite people about a minimum order.
Right.
So what that means is to get past that, you have to pay quite an exceptionally large tooling cost.
Mm.
You know, yeah, but yeah. We think it's worth it to end up with unique, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly. And I think that you know, what are you going to do, Zach? We've had this conversation before. Watches are generally round or square or oblong, mm-hmm. and they have hands that go round on a dial. You know, to have a really sharp DNA so that if you were covering up the name of on your dial, could people tell that it's your watch? I think that's really critical to try and achieve.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because when you think about the fact that there's certain trends right now and that people seem to kind of get almost like angry if you don't sort of stay within, you know, certain aspects of watch design that are kind of very hot right now. But at the same time, if you don't continue to push forward and create new things and do something different, you know, what are you doing? How are you going to get the person to buy the next watch? And, you know, it sounds like that's something you guys put a lot of development into in these kind of materials and taking the hard route, but it's, which, you know, it's essentially part of the challenge and the opportunity. I mean, you got to keep your product fresh, but you also have to stay within the boundaries, I guess, of what people are even interested in.
Yeah. Also, and the other thing is that, look, Sellita are working on a range of movements for commercial release in 2021 that are amazing. And you want to be working in parallel with them so you could take advantage of their substantial investment in development of movements generally, you know.
Certainly.
So that requires to work out a long time, because development of a movement to such a level that they're confident that it's going to be perform as it's meant to in all circumstances takes forever in testing, right? Takes forever. But they're a great, you know, people are starting to ask me if I have shares in Sellita. I don't, but they're, you know, they're great that they share that and that they're working in you, and you're able to adapt your potential models to, you know, optimize that. You look at the SW510 now, mm-hmm. there's five or six people using it, and it's a fantastic movement. So I think it's great that five or six people are using it. I'm sure as Sellita movements become more readily, more developed as they are, because their catalog gets fatter all the time.
Yeah.
Then I think it gives people like us a lot of opportunity. You know, you're able to modify the movements to some extent. You can COSE them if you want to do, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you can finish them in any way you want, elaborately. But all of this takes a lot of time and a lot of planning.
Last up is Jason Lim from Helios.
I mean, assuming a world with no pandemic, it kind of sounds like science fiction at this point.
Yeah, very much.
But, you know, I'm thinking, let's say we don't analyze indicators like, you know, macro buying habits or where business is coming from. I think we were actually in a really good place. Like, we were on a really encouraging trajectory in terms of watches really entering the mainstream subconscious.
Okay.
And by this, I mean, like, you know, mainstream media outlets. So, I mean, when you have people like Nick Sullivan, like the creative director of Esquire, mm-hmm. writing regular watch column. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like arguably very interesting people like Moki Martin talking about watches. It feels like we're really onto something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's sort of progressed from just a niche geeky sort of thing to something that's really mainstream. And people are actually discovering they can go really deep with it, as deep as they want.
Yeah.
Watches, it relates in some way to some facet of their lives at some level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're in a really good place as far as awareness, mainstream appeal.
Mm.
So that's one of the biggest opportunities that I see. And I hope after everything kind of gets relatively back to normal, we can kind of continue on that path as well.
Yeah. I was just going to say, no, it's very interesting to think about that, the idea of kind of mainstream infiltration of the watch culture, because you're absolutely right. And I just kind of stop and think about the various places now that I regularly see watch content. And, you know, I don't know if everybody goes to like news.google.com to get their news. Probably not, but it's just, you know, it's there. I'm on the internet all the time. So I go there and, you know, there's like a section for you. And so it pulls up a lot of watch content for me from places I frankly don't know. I mean, sometimes, you know, Blog to Watch is on there, sometimes Hodinkee's on there, sometimes we're on there. But then, yeah, you get the Esquires, you get the GQs, you get other kind of mainstream media sites or sites that certainly aren't watch centric. And, right. But they're getting into interesting things. It's not just, you know, oh, look at this celebrity's watch. It's like, you know, these are the popular vintage watches. These are, you know, they're getting. So, yeah, I mean, that is interesting. So, like, the framework is there for the watch industry to kind of, or like, at least hopefully the kind of more niche watch industry to kind of make its way into more people's minds. I like that.
Yeah. And I think they're also, I mean, it's thanks to you guys as well, in part, you know, the media that has kind of created this rich content, but they're also kind of nudging the public into thinking about watches the way a watch nerd would think about mm-hmm. watches. It's not just the name brand or whatever it is. You can go a little bit deeper than that. The provenance, the design, people behind the company.
Yeah.
Things like that, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, at the same level, since it's becoming kind of, I don't want to say saturated quite yet, but prolific, one of the challenges is that as a brand, mm-hmm. you know, how do you kind of sort through the noise? How do you rise above everything that's out there? And I don't think that's quite a problem yet for mm-hmm. most companies, but it also provides the challenge of, you know, making sure your message is on point, because there's so many different types of customers. Mm-hmm. And is a watch company sort of stratifying their advertising, their targeting, their marketing, their messaging? You know, like online versus brick and mortar, mm-hmm. traditional retail channels. So I think that's one of the challenges that hopefully hopefully it'll arise. It's a great problem to have. You know, yep. You have a lot of people interested in your product and you just want to find out the right way to convey your message.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what strategies do you take in those regards?
You have known me for so long and you're asking me about strategy.
Sorry.
Next question.
Fair enough.
You know what? I think.
I mean, you operate differently. It's part of the reason why I wanted to talk with you versus, you know, and, you know, the other brands that I've posed these questions to are all a little bit different in how they approach things. So, don't take it as an insult. I'm just always curious.
I'm joking. I'm completely joking.
Yeah.
The only thing that I try to do is just, at the very simple level, I just want to make something that brings somebody joy, brings myself joy. Mm-hmm. So as far as strategy goes, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. Maybe we can circle back on that.
Okay. The strategy is to think about strategy. Yeah. No.
The strategy is to have no strategy.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I think as a micro brand, I think mm-hmm. the strategy is, honestly, I'm getting bored with a lot of watches.
Mm.
So everything kind of is starting to look the same.
Okay.
And I don't want to differentiate just for the sake of differentiating. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that whatever I come out with, I look at it and I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then mm-hmm. as far as product planning and quantity planning goes, I want to make it easy for customers to buy, hence the mm-hmm. release of Fairwind. I've only notified people on the subscriber list. I haven't put anything on social media.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make the process easier. And I kind of want to shake off this mantle of, oh, you know, it's selling on hype. It's selling on FOMO.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can only get one of the watches if you're super lucky or whatever, right? It's mm-hmm. not, fully not true. And that kind of narrative has kind of proliferated on the internet by folks mm-hmm. who probably wouldn't have been customers anyways.
Okay.
So I think strategy is twofold: create something super interesting to myself and what I think the customers might find, or at mm-hmm. least try to. And number two, make sure at least there's adequate quantity so that I'm not playing the hype game.
Okay.
So that would be the strategy.
And I mean, and that seems a little bit like, so, you know, your recent watches, or the last couple of years, the C4th, I mean, those did sell out very quickly. So is this sort of a response to that?
Yeah. So the C4th, when the C4th 2 came out, it was kind of at the cusp, of actually, getting wider recognition.
Okay.
So before that, it was fine because it was mostly watch enthusiasts, forum people. They kind of understood how these releases go, how the production process goes. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the cusp. So people tried to buy it and got pissed off. And actually, C4-3 was actually an open pre-order. So there's a large quantity of them out there. Mm. And they were not difficult to get.
Okay.
But the majority of people who've just, you know, started hearing about the brand, they sort of missed that portion of the story.
Right.
And so like perpetuating, it's tough to get. So, you know, I'm constantly trying to make it easier. Like, you know, if you want one, you can get one. Mm-hmm. However, I don't want to sit on stock or inventory. So I'm trying to plan as well as I can.
Yeah.
And if someone misses a batch, you know, there's going to be something cooler coming after that. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. Yeah.
You know, something I touched on with some of the other people I talked to is, you know, kind of challenges around manufacturing. You know, and since you've been doing this for some time, like, how have you seen manufacturing change?
So manufacturing, I'll speak specifically to manufacturing in Asia first, okay, because that's kind of where I started out. I think the quality has gone up tremendously. And I think you and Ilya mentioned before that, you know, brands that are starting up now, their first watch is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Amazing. I could not have done this for the price they're offering it at 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's just the learning curve is just improved so much. And the factories now, they have so much experience under their belt. So the quality has definitely gone up, which is a fantastic thing for consumers. Mm-hmm. Having said that, though, I feel that as a brand, I've kind of hit a ceiling with the capabilities of my current suppliers. Okay. So I am looking more towards Swiss manufacturing. And not just because, you know, it's Swiss, whatever. I don't want to put Swiss made on the dial. I'm not chasing that in any way. But it happens to be some of the best manufacturers of certain components are located in these countries and this part of the world. So that's all that matters to me. Mm-hmm. I just want to push the quality as high as I can, maintaining a fair price around what I would pay as a consumer based on my costs.
Right. And do you find that manufacturing currently is like keeping up with demand?
Right now, so the situation in Asia is, they can keep up with demand. They've kind of opened things up more now. I'm not sure if there's going to be another occurrence. But right now in Switzerland, interesting that you'd say that is, they cannot keep up with their orders at the moment because they are shut down.
Right.
So this doesn't really affect someone like me. It probably affects more like the high end. Mm-hmm. They make 25 pieces a year, that kind of thing. But at the moment, it's unprecedented. So it's super and go, and it's really it's a big unknown right now.
Yeah. I mean the COVID-19 situation, obviously, it affects a lot of things. But yeah, specifically manufacturing is affected in a very obvious way. But I think the ripples are going to be felt for some time. But it's always interesting to hear. You know, I feel like I talk to 10 different brands and I get 10 different answers about like what the biggest challenge is to manufacturing, whether it's movement supply, case manufacturers, you know, you can name it. There's somebody has a problem somewhere along the supply chain. So I'm always interested to kind of hear, frankly, everyone's opinion on that.
Yeah, I think there's challenges at every stage and every sort of slice of production.
Yeah.
I guess whatever resonates the most with them based on their suppliers. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. What problems are you hearing the most? Movement supply? Movement supply is an issue too.
I hear movement supply the most. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's some, it depends, you know, different types of movements. But I think every single kind of movement you could imagine, people are having challenge, you know, getting it. Sometimes you hear, Miyota 9000 series, they're just better. They're backlogged 6 months or whatever. And then you hear like, I can't get a chronograph to save my life. And then GMTs, it's everyone is finding specific. And then another person will be like, yeah, I got a stockpile of those. Don't tell anyone. You know,
it's just the address, please.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's just interesting. I think there's a lot of obviously nuance to doing what you do, and, you know, I think people really underestimate the challenge of finding good suppliers and finding good, you know, materials and things like that. I mean, even in the smallest way, like with our straps, you know, we run out of a leather, and sometimes we can't get that leather because the minimum order is like 10,000 square feet or something. We're like, yeah, that's too many straps for that one color. So that's out now, you know, until they have some leftover hides, and you kind of work around it. But yeah, it's a constant challenge.
I know. And you replace the hide and then it looks different. Somebody notices and calls you internet.
Yeah. Oh, man. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.